Hey, everybody. It's Jim and Aaron, and we are back with yet another commission podcast, doing the old catch-up, trying to get caught up to our deep stack of commissions.
And yeah, the great content drought of 2018 continues.
Yes.
With another three podcast week.
Sean Ray contributed this one. Now, if you recognize the name Sean Ray, it's because he is famous for commissioning the Insidious Volumes 1 and 2. I wonder how excited he is about the next Insidious. It looks pretty scary. I'm excited about it. And also the Coen Brothers directorial debut, Blood Simple. This time he was motivated by our discussion of American Gangster and our love for Ridley Scott to do a deep cut, 1989 police hard-boiled thriller, Black Rain.
Yeah.
Starring Michael Douglas, Andy Garcia, bunch of other people, like the chief of staff from West Wing is in here.
Okay,
Stephen Fry, Stephen Root. Stephen Root comes out of nowhere as an internal affairs officer.
God,
you'll see a very young, wet behind the ears Stephen Root trying to catch a wily old Michael. Not even that old, oldish.
Yeah, trying to pin him to the wall on some. Turns out not so bogus, trumped up
police corruption.
Actually,
charges.
No, they're exactly.
Why can't you skim? Why can't you skim at the top if you're a cop?
Right,
you know?
They got a family.
I got divorced. Yeah. What am I supposed to do? Just, you know, not pay my ex-wife. Let's talk about this movie. This movie is noteful for a couple of reasons I want to talk about, but also historically, it's the first collaboration between Ridley Scott and Hans Zimmer, who have done just tons and tons of work together. Gladiator, Thelma and Louise, Hannibal, Black Hawk Down, Matchstick Men, to name just a few. Jim, what did you think about this movie?
So I think unlike the other commissions that Sean Ray has done, this is the first movie that I didn't quite appreciate in the way that I think he would have liked me to. It's not a bad movie. I don't think it's particularly bad. I think it just is so entrenched in the formulas of the genre as I see them that it never breaks free and it never becomes very interesting for me. It has a style to it, and I think it's more style over substance here.
Yeah,
unfortunately.
And that's the thing. Like, a lot of this movie just feels very dated in terms of like messaging and imagery, and like even the score. The things that don't are, you know, Ridley Scott knows how to shoot a scene.
Sure.
And there's a lot of things where I felt like he was really hammering Japan into a Blade Runner shape.
Oh, absolutely.
Like during
Blade Runner is all over
the flight into Osaka, like that industrial, like plumes coming out is very reminiscent of like, you know, just the Blade Runner cityscape. And then the version of like the Japanese version of Times Square, you know, their central, there's just like giant billboards of geisha girls drinking Coke. That's actually Blade Runner. Sorry, I got my wires confused. I think Michael Douglas is not a conventional action star. You can make Michael Douglas work in badass roles. Like Falling Down, I don't think he's a laudable badass. He's a complicated badass, but he has certainly got a kind of ferocious, you know, scary kind of vibe to him that honestly he could have. I think if he had gone less John McClane and more falling down, buttoned down by the book guy who snapped because of something, like, you know, a divorce that he can't afford and the death of his partner, it might have worked better. Because, like, this movie was fighting uphill because, number one, Sean Ray was asking, in my mind, it was connected to American Gangster. And I'm like, oh, this might be another one of those gems that I'm kind of, like, overlooked. And then the first 5 minutes, Michael Douglas rocks a look that I can only describe as what Philip from The Americans would wear as disguise when he's hitting on 14-year-olds.
Okay, that's fair.
I expected him to roar off after he won the motorcycle race and hit up some 14-year-old blonde with Beatles records and a dime bag of weed. You know, like it's once I saw that I could not unsee.
I was thinking like the, I guess, old man version of Kurt Russell. from a lot of his movies.
He's not
like
even
Big Trouble
that.
Little China.
He's not even pulling that.
It's the hair. It's the hair.
It's the hair for sure. It's the hair. And Michael Douglas, good looking guy.
Sure.
I'm sure he's one of People's Magazine's sexiest man alive.
Probably.
But not with this hair. Not with that leather jacket. Not with these undercover detective suits.
There was absolutely a role for Michael Douglas to play in the 80s, and he played that superbly.
Wall Street is
a fantastic role for Michael Douglas.
Right. Fatal Attraction,
this,
right?
Like, long-haired Kurt Russell-esque badass is not really what I picture him as, I suppose.
Right.
So yeah, it threw me a little bit.
Let's get to Sean's feedback, and then we can talk about the movie some more. Okay. He says, "Hey guys, I listened to your American Gangster podcast today, and that commissioner asked you to rank American Gangster in the pantheon of Ridley Scott films. And Black Rain is another Ridley Scott film. This is all facts.
Yes.
Facts. So if you don't mind, would you please rank Black Rain with the other Ridley Scott films you've seen?
Oh boy.
Compare and contrast this film with other possible badass 80s action films. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the 89 neo-noir Ridley Scott film Black Rain. I really enjoy watching Ridley's films because I think he's a master at transporting the audience to places they've never been before, whether it's Alien, Blade Runner, or Black Rain. Even though this isn't sci-fi, I feel like he does a great job of portraying Japan in an otherworldly quality as the audiences, are fish out of water, like Michael Douglas or Andy Garcia. This begins as just another 80s cop movie that comes complete with cheesy motorcycle race and a rough around the edges dirty cop just trying to pay his child support. But once Nick and Charlie get over to Japan, I feel it becomes something more, or at least tries to be." He talks about some of his favorite scenes that maybe we can get around to at the end of the podcast. And also, I want to return to the whole ranking of Ridley Scott to the end of the podcast as well.
Okay.
I think a lot of things you're talking about here, Sean, certainly stick out. And so there's a lot of themes in this movie that I want to talk about. Michael Douglas is essentially the walking ugly American stereotype.
Yeah.
He comes into this situation. The setup is Michael Douglas is perhaps a dirty cop. He's under investigation by the Internal Affairs Bureau Division. Andy Garcia is his younger, kind of straight-laced detective partner.
Mm-hmm.
Although equally, he's flat. I think he's dirty, too. He's wearing $80 loafers, and he's flashing his clothes around. Like, yeah, maybe they're in on it together.
Yeah.
But he believes that he's not dirty. Michael Douglas isn't dirty, and they are after a fairly disastrous interview with Internal Affairs, where Michael Douglas essentially pounds the table and says, "I'm guilty, fine, but what about the other politicians?" You know, his lawyer was like appropriately chagrined at this. They're having a drink out, and they're kind of like eyeballing the local mafia, and suddenly a bunch of Yakuza dudes come in and brutally assassinate these Japanese gentlemen that are having lunch with the mafia, and they get into this protracted gun battle, and it ends up with Michael Douglas capturing this one Japanese guy, and he fights for the right to transport him to justice over in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Movie
so that's,
over.
That's the setup of the movie. Unfortunately, the Yakuza does
they
something.
They pull the old switcheroo on
them. It's not even sophisticated. It's just they basically show up in trench coats and say, "We'll take it from here, buddy." And Michael Douglas is like, "Whatever."
And they say it in Japanese so that nobody understands it from America. And they get away with it.
And like the thing is that he's in full John McClane, like, "Look here, pal. I don't know how they do it across the ocean in an entirely different culture of different people and histories and stuff, but here in America we do it this way." And it's embarrassing because Andy Garcia just going around, like, he refers to a Japanese guy as a racial slur for Japanese as he's asking if anyone in this office speaks English. What's funny about that is, of course, at least half the people in this police office speak English, because almost everywhere you go in the world, Americans are the most monolingual peoples on the planet.
Mm.
And if a Japanese guy came to fucking New York City and went to like a random precinct and wanted, like, there's no way in hell anyone would speak Japanese.
Right.
But Michael Douglas is not aware of the contradiction of that and just expects the entire world to bend to his will and whims.
Yeah, no, I do not like the Michael Douglas character throughout this entire film.
Right.
It's not even just because you think, and I think the movie thinks that it does a better job at this of coming to some kind of equilibrium between Michael Douglas and the Japanese detective that he's paired up with. But I don't think it does.
No.
I think the final gesture of this movie is basically the Americans saying, hey, we're going to do things our way.
Mm-hmm.
And you should probably do them that way, too, because they're awesome.
Right.
And that's the attitude that Michael Douglas carries with him throughout this entire movie is, I don't care how you do it.
Uh-huh.
I'm a cop from New York. Like, we
right.
have the toughest New York, like, cop jobs on the planet.
Right.
We know best. And I just don't. I don't like anything about his attitude.
Well, like the whole thing
he's just an asshole. And the worst thing about it is, like, he's paired up with this cop who I think would be a cool guy if he weren't with Michael Douglas.
I was just saying that Andy Garcia is the one that actually makes headway in kind of bridging the cultural gap because he's actually putting forth an effort.
Right.
An effort to be friendly, an effort to be polite and respectful, an effort to...
He doesn't disdain the other culture. He wants to show them some of what he's about, also willing to know what they're about.
Yeah, like, what would Michael Douglas do if a Japanese cop came over to investigate something in New York City and Michael Douglas put out his hand for a handshake and the Japanese guy just spit in it? Like, that's essentially, like, you know, Andy Garcia's trying to do the respectful bow.
Yeah.
And Michael Douglas doesn't have time for any of that bullshit.
Right.
Yeah, and there's, like, I don't... Like, there is some interesting things where, like, Michael Douglas tries to hoist the Japanese cops on their own petard. Like, you know, this cop has got a problem with the fact that Michael Douglas is dirty.
Uh-huh.
Which I have a problem
with,
too.
Yep.
And yet Michael Douglas tries to make every point he tries to make, like, it's strongly implied, and I have to watch the movie again to see if this is actually true, if it's just something I picked up. It's strongly implied that the Japanese police are super corrupt, that they are kind of looking the other way and letting this gang war kind of work itself out, and that maybe the police chief is actually protecting the upstarts against the, you know, the entrenched Japanese Yakuza, the older Japanese Yakuza.
Potentially. I feel like they don't follow up enough with that, if that's what they're going for.
I felt like, too. Like, some, it could just be because, like, the times where it looks like interference, Michael Douglas is just waving a gun crazy in public, something that he's been warned that he cannot do as a police officer. It's like, you know, he's a crazy guy that gets taken down by a bunch of Japanese. Is that because the Japanese cops are in on Sato's scheme, or is it because Michael Douglas is waving a country in a country that you don't, that don't have guns on the street, waving a pistol around and screaming in a crowded public area and causing mass hysteria?
Yeah, either one would be a plausible explanation.
He's also a 6'2" American loudly screaming and waving. Michael Douglas takes the point on a surveillance operation. Mm-hmm. The giant American wearing a trench coat with a ludicrously huge walkie-talkie. Like, why can't his Japanese partner be the point guy on the ground?
Right.
Like, try to blend in. Like, you sit back and pull up the wheels. You know, was it Maz? I think that's his partner.
Maz or Masa, they call him. A couple of different
let
things.
That guy take point and be on the enormous walkie-talkie.
Yeah. No, at least he'll blend in a little bit better.
Right.
Than your conspicuous American ass just waving a gun around.
Right.
No, and I also have this huge problem with the attitude of, hey, I got a family, so skimming off the top, being dirty is cool.
Yeah, his defense, like, I thought they would, like, his kid got really sick or something, but, like, it's essentially, like, when the guy accuses him of being dirty... Michael Douglas is like, hey, man, I was going through a divorce. What was I supposed to do?
Yeah.
And, you know, to his credit, the Japanese cop's like, look, you are disgracing yourself and your partner by acting like this as a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you and I'm like, that there is no comeback to that, because if a cop picks you up for anything and you're like, hey, man, look, I'm just trying to feed my kids, guess how much sympathy you would get?
Right.
You would get zero sympathy. You would use that as an admission of guilt. And you would be reamed out by the legal process, rightfully so.
By that exact same cop who is justifying taking money off the top for his own family.
Right. Like, maybe you sell your Harley.
Uh-huh.
Maybe you stop doing illegal underground racing under the Brooklyn Bridge.
But he made $50 out
of that. $50. Yeah. Like, maybe that's also part of the illegal things that he has to do to make money, to make ends meet. But yeah, like it's funny because the movie itself doesn't do a whole lot to win us over to Michael Douglas' side. It's just that he's not as boring as the Japanese police officers. So, and he talks his partner into being, you know, like doing a whole bunch of crazy American cop John McClane bullshit, which is cool. Like I do feel like the death of Andy Garcia, it doesn't make sense because it feels like that's a very foolish thing for the Yakuza to do, to murder an American cop on Japanese soil in a very showy way. Mm-hmm. But it's the first time in the movie where I'm like, okay, because I really liked Andy Garcia and his character. But it's the first time in the movie, like, okay, I'm kind of on board with this revenge thing now. I've had enough of this upstart young Yakuza that wants to murder everybody, and he just fucking killed Andy Garcia and his magnificent chest hair, and he needs to die.
I didn't notice the chest hair, but
how did you not know?
Yeah,
I would like to see Andy Garcia with his shirt off now.
Okay,
because from what I could tell from his unbuttoned shirt, it has got like a grizzly bear pelt. A grizzly bear pelt is from at least his groin to his collarbone. That's crazy amount of body hair, and like not even like your conventional kind of curly pubic kind of body hair. It's like it looked like a pelt.
Oh, like straight, like fur,
like I don't want to say worse, because I like as a hairy man himself, I'd be running my own self down, but like just an probably solid pelt of hair, like Austin Powers-esque, only more so.
All right, well, good for you, Andy.
Yeah, I gotta see a picture of Andy Garcia with the shirt off now.
That was definitely the scene that like I guess brought me halfway around on this movie, because up until that point, I was not enjoying much of this movie. And then there was the scene in, I guess it was like a train station or something, right before Andy Garcia gets killed, where the guy on the motorcycle comes in. He tries to do this stupid, you know, matador thing. And the guy yanks his coat and takes it. And I was like, yes, that's awesome. And there was just a couple funny lines there. And then, yeah, once he ran down there, and the shot where Andy Garcia is killed and you see Michael Douglas behind that fence is just a really beautiful shot.
It is.
There's a lot of really good looking stuff in this.
Like I said, Ridley Scott knows how to fucking shoot. Like, yeah. He's just, this movie made me realize that Ridley Scott is just a much better version of Michael Bay. He's like the richest man's version of Michael Bay, because they both know how to work the magic hour. They both know how to get like really cool dynamic shots, even when there's not a lot going on. The idea, like, there's a couple things where, like, they were filming some of this motorcycle stuff, and they, like, framed the shot in a particular link of a chain link fence that I just, like, wow, it's stuff that's, like, it's throwaway kind of elegance in filmmaking that you get kind of for free. Like, because I've never seen a bad-looking Ridley Scott film.
No.
Never. I've seen Ridley Scott films I thought were pointless or wrong-headed, such as the latest Aliens movie, but I've never been like, boy, that just thing looks like total dog shit.
No. And part of that, I guess, comes down to this movie was actually shot by the guy who did Speed later on, or was about to go on to do Speed.
So he knows a little bit about shooting action and
dynamicism. Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing that was interesting is, like, I was shocked, and I never would have suspected this, that this movie was primarily shot in California.
I assumed it was
shot in Japan, because they, you know, there's obviously a lot of establishing shots in Japan, but when they get to this scene towards the end of the film where there's this like gun battle in a iron smelting for a facility, I'm like, that's the scene where Arnold gets melted in Terminator 2.
Okay.
I'm utterly convinced I've seen those exact same shots, and I looked it up, and I'll be damned if I wasn't right, that was actually filmed at the California Steel industry building in Fontana, California. In fact, I guess they intended to shoot the majority of this in Japan, but there was problems with the Japanese film officials and getting the permit, so they're just like, fuck it, we'll just do some very quick establishing street shots and film everything in America.
Yeah, that's surprising.
But they do a really good job.
Yeah, they do a pretty good job faking it. There are like a lot of scenes in very close quarters, kind of alleys, where you get a lot of like storefronts and stuff, and it all has the feel of Japan. So,
oh, yeah.
I think they do that well. And also, like, they must have rigged up these trucks. So these crazy ass trucks. Were you noticing those throughout the film?
No.
Just how did you not notice them? They're literally flashing lights on every inch of these trucks, these semis, and that's like a subculture in Japan where semi drivers and truck drivers, like we think of American truck drivers as like fancying up their trucks and stuff. Mm-hmm. The semi drivers. Mm-hmm. Japan takes it to another level, man.
Really?
It's crazy.
Okay, so they're not like billboard trucks. They're just trucks that the guys have gussied up.
Right. With just a ton of lights, like hundreds of lights and crazy fins and all sorts of stuff.
Wow.
And they were just all over the place. Like they'd randomly pop up, like Michael Douglas would be running down a street and then three trucks behind him all with flashing crazy lights.
No, I did not notice any of
just
that.
Just like I didn't notice Andy Garcia's chest.
You didn't. Yeah,
Maybe if they put some lights on it.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, if they've strung it up like a Douglas fir, you would have noticed. But or maybe if there was like a pelt of if they did it at all like monster fur.
Uh-huh.
If the trucks, I would have noticed that right away. But no, that's the thing, like so Terminator 2 came out. Probably was produced roughly 2 years after this film. I'm convinced that James Cameron lifted a lot of stuff from this film. Because I think he would have seen it. He would have seen it was a Scott film. And he would have gone to see it. And he's like, I love this smelting location. It's essentially used in the same way, too. There's like a lot of like motorcycle shots, like the like Andy Garcia sprinting after this guy on a dirt bike, which is very reminiscent of the T-1000. By the way, unless you're T-1000, don't go fucking running after a motorcycle.
Yeah,
you're just asking a guy to fuck with you, or worst case scenario, murder you. Like it's not, you're not going to like flying tackle him off his motorcycle. He can go 0 to 60 in like 2.3 seconds, and your broke ass can't run faster than 20 miles an hour. Just stop. Your best bet is to give up, and he might get bored and drop your coat, and you can go slink over and get it. Yeah. But like, there's a lot of like shots that really reminded me of the Terminator 2, and I tried to do a little bit of research to see if like I saw like James Cameron like say like, oh, I saw Black Rain, and I knew I had my third act of my movie. Mm-hmm. Couldn't find anything like that. But it's striking how much of those images map one, like even similar camera moves, panning over similar parts of the steel factory. The fact that you got this tense kind of like shootout and like, you know, hunting people through this thing. It's like, it is very, all you needed is a liquid nitrogen truck to ram in brightly colored.
Yeah.
Christmas trees all over, Christmas tree lights all over the place. All you need is that. And then it would be Terminator 2.
Yeah. It's remarkable, you know, how much this movie does feel like Blade Runner in places too. We've talked a little bit about it, but this is like the most neo of neo-noir kind of movies, you know, whereas Blade Runner is like the prime example of that. Mm-hmm. This is sort of like a toned down version of it, or maybe the most extreme example I've seen of it in a real world setting.
Right.
That isn't like some fictionalized future. So I
think that's why a lot of Americans like going to Japan, because it does feel like you're living 20 years in the future all the time.
Right. Right. And I do like the style of this movie a lot. There are a lot of things like those crazy trucks in the background. Sato's glasses are just crazy. They look like something out of like Ghost in the Shell, or just these crazy, almost steampunk looking glasses. Very cool. And I think I like the soundtrack. They're doing the best they can with the sense of the ages.
I was gonna say, to
squeak out some kind of like hybrid of Japanese, American, neo-noir detective thing. Like, I think I like it.
I felt it felt fairly dated.
It does, but like, if you took that, because I'm thinking of movies like Drive and movies of like kind of the modern renaissance of that style, and they have much better tools.
Right.
But in 1989, you had these Moog synthesizers that were like kind of there or getting there, and they try to do the best they could with them.
You think Dave Porter's soundtrack for Breaking Bad will feel dated in like 20 years?
Probably.
Because
yeah.
I'd feel,
or
like,
certainly of the time, yeah.
I wonder, because like, to me, it's such a, he makes such interesting and weird choices that it's like, it's never going to feel dated. Like, there's a couple things you can do. Like, Godfather score doesn't feel dated.
Sure. Yeah.
Because, well, it's a period piece, number one, and those always kind of feel timeless. And I guess that's what you should always, if I was making a movie and I wanted to be like a movie for the ages, I would try to go for something like that because they do feel timeless. Mm-hmm. And I know sometimes it works, like we talked about in the movie Seven. But that movie is aggressively of the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. Like you, it's almost a period piece filmed. Well, I mean, I guess that's what it is, yeah. Right? Like Taxi sure. Driver isn't a period piece, but it looks like one now because it was set in a time and, you know, you get some of that stuff for free. I guess maybe some eras are less timeless than others.
Yeah, like I think the 70s age poorly.
The late 80s, the midnight. Maybe it's all maybe that's I'm stumbling into something that style is fickle and mm-hmm. it like but I was it's funny cuz I was my wife and I turned on the PlayStation a couple weeks back and they were touting that all 8 Harry Potter films are now on HBO Go. Huh. And we're like, holy shit, we can have an ABC family weekend any weekend we want. And we watched a couple of them and I was watching the third one. I'm like, Daniel Radcliffe looks like a teenager, a stylish teenager now. Emma Watson is dressed like a stylish teenager now. Fucking Ron Weasley, whoever he looks like a stylish. Like, how does this movie that was made 10, 12 years ago? Like, I don't know, because it's not like they were wearing weird wizard robes or stuff. It's just like okay. They were wearing like contemporary kids' clothes, and they still look like they could fit in. And I think if you went back to the 90s, they'd still look kind of cool.
That's impressive, a way to do that. They're kind of in the uncanny valley of nostalgia, like style nostalgia at this point. Like,
yeah.
To be from like the early 2000s and to have had a style that you could consider cool today,
right,
is a damn tough thing to pull off.
Really, it is.
Give it another 10 years, and it'll be back in fashion. But like,
or you can do some things that are just a force. Like, I feel like the bride in her iconic tracksuit was pretty dated and kind of retro, but it was cool because it's aping, like, you know, Bruce Lee stuff, and like the association of the character and the fact that she's such so ferocious and badass, it kind of like works. But there's none of that here. Like, they're wearing big double-breasted suits with like, you know, silk ties with super skinny knots, and
Andy Garcia would not have been out of place in Wall Street.
No,
like the movie.
Right. Yeah.
And it definitely feels like the 80s, but
the other thing I was excited about this film that I was ultimately disappointed about was Kate Capshaw, who is also known as the worst thing about the terrible Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. She's just she stands out in she's like if there is only one Bond girl that sucked or was forgettable or annoying in James Bond, like that's kind of like her for Indiana Jones, because all the like I really like Elsa from the third one, I really like Marion from the first one, but Kate Capshaw's character in the Temple of Doom is just terrible.
Yeah, the character is bad.
It's like every second she's on screen, but I'm like, but there was something interesting about her herself. That I'm like, you know, if I ever get a chance to watch her in something, I think it'd be cool. And I noticed she got like third billing right underneath Douglas and Garcia, and I'm like, ah, cool. I could totally. I'm really interested, but they don't really give her much to do.
No, they don't.
She's not offensive. She's not bad, but like, she also didn't like completely blow me away. And also, she's essentially just exposition. Mm-hmm. Like,
she's the breadcrumbs that lead Michael Douglas to the bad guy.
Right, and the fact that they're running she puts together a lot of stuff for him that I kind of feel like feels a little bit like lazy screenwriting. Like, Michael Douglas could have actually done some investigating and sweated, but it's like he just found the first American girl he could see and, like, you know, turned on the Michael Douglas charm, and I don't know. Also, there's a big scene later where he's like, thanks her for picking the right team, and I'm like, where did this come from? Because she hasn't really. It's like,
well, she gave him information that led him, I guess, to Sugai.
But there was no like existential soul searching. I mean, she did say like, "Oh, you're getting over your head, and you don't know what you're doing here, and you're a gay gaijin, and you're just a foreigner barbarian, and you should keep your head down." But like, that scene is also the scene where she gave him information about the gang war and the counterfeiting operation and all that stuff. So. Yeah. I don't know. It felt like it was
a little.
Like, maybe there was another scene where there was a little bit more to that, and they cut it. Because the other thing is that the film was over 2 hours, and it felt kind of long, I thought. In fact, it's one of those things where, like, I thought the third act was concluding, and there's 40 more minutes of film to go. Because that was like I felt like the climax of the film was going to be in that steel factory. But no, there was this rice paddy invasion.
Well, I knew that the film was not going to, or the climax of the film would involve Michael Douglas on a motorcycle. That's the one thing that I was 100% sure of.
Yes, because else why have the just ridiculous street racing scene underneath the
Brooklyn
that's
what
Bridge.
I mean when I say it's so formulaic as to be, you know, not interesting.
This
to
is
me.
Chekhov's Harley.
Right.
Be ready for it to come back later.
And that's fine, but it's a little predictable.
The other thing is, like, I thought when they kept the mystery of what's in the box, what's in the box? I thought that would be a lot more interesting than what it ended up being revealed in. Like, I thought it was going to be some kind of, like, I don't know, fucking calligraphy set or some stone tea. Like it's some
something
kind of,
Michael Douglas wouldn't understand.
Something like very distinct to Yakuza culture that, like, would be very meaningful for the people that were fighting the war, but an outsider would be like, the fuck?
Yeah, that's the one thing they don't get into at all is, like, the Yakuza culture.
They do a little, like, there's a couple things, like, in 89, like, this guy cutting us, like, we know a lot about Yakuza culture because, we've been fascinated with it for several decades, but I'm sure
the finger thing is, like, the one thing.
Yeah, and the tattoos, like, the fact that they got these, like, full body sleeve tattoos.
They never clue Michael Douglas in to the things.
He's so proud to be ignorant about that. Right.
That's true. That's fair. As a viewer, I understand that. But
I wanted a sequel to this just so Moss could come over to United States and tell Michael Douglas to blow it out his ass about Cosa Nostra. And, like, he's trying to explain how the Italian mob works and all that. And, like, he's like, fuck you, man.
Right.
You know? It turns out to be a counterfeiting operation, which I feel like one of the other theses of the movies was that, like, there's this Yakuza, but also kind of, I guess, Japanese businessman, where he's talking about the counterfeit operation that, and Michael Douglas is saying, like, oh, I could tell your bills are phony, blah, blah, blah. And the guy's like, oh, that's because that was just a prototype, the actual counterfeiting plates that are in this box.
Are you talking about the guy who, when he speaks English, sounds like Jabba the Hutt?
Oh, I thought he sounded like the Japanese Darth Vader.
Yeah.
His voice is amazing.
That can't be his voice, right? They got a separate actor, and they ran him through, like, a synthesizer. And
I think he's the character
and
that died of bladder cancer, like, a month after this thing got done filming.
Oh, boy.
I got him. Like, he's the Japanese Darth Vader, and he sounds amazing. But he's got this line about, like, the final product is, like, everything else we do. It's a perfect copy. And I'm like, is that a sly, not so sly dig at like Japanese, that could be the executive of Sony bragging about his copy of a Panasonic hi-fi stereo receiver.
Right. Right.
And there was a little bit of that, because it's hard for me because there was, like, this kind of Asian panic, like, oh my God, Japan's going to take over the world. They're buying up all of our real estate and they own all of Hawaii. And, like, you know, like this.
Yeah.
This stuff, and, like, I'm thinking, like, this movie was kind of like in a piece with, like, this, like, Steve Guttenberg Gung Ho, which I know is a giant racist piece of shit movie, but there was a lot of that kind of in the cultural milieu, and I wondered if that was just kind of like American audience are laughing up their sleeves about, like, the Japanese ultimate end game is just copying our money, like, eliminate all the middlemen and just start fabricating Benjamins.
Sure.
And how did I feel about that? And my brain said, I don't know.
That's the thing. I think this movie is trying to do something to bridge cultures. I think it just fails.
It's not completely wrongheaded for sure.
It's so, like, entrenched in the ideas of race relations between those two countries in the 80s.
Right. And there's a lot of...
It can't satisfy me as a 2017, 2018 viewer.
Let's say there's a lot of broad characterizations of the Japanese being, like, even the evil ones, quote-unquote, being consumed with the idea of duty and honor.
Sure.
Like Michael Douglas, who has no duty and no honor, is lectured constantly by the police, by Kate Capshaw, by the fucking Yakuzas about duty and honor, duty and honor, duty and honor, duty and honor. Yeah. That is a Japanese note that they hit over and over. And Michael Douglas, comes back with like, oh, you gotta know when to ignore your head and grab your ball. He says so much stupid shit. Like he goes to question one of the people they have in custody, and he begins it with a headbutt.
Uh-huh.
And when the Japanese is like, what the hell are you doing? He's like, hey man, I just want to talk with him. Hey, just want to talk. Like, it's crazy. And the guy's like, the guy comes up to him and says, hey, look, this is a quote from the movie. This isn't New York City. There are rules.
Right.
Right.
And that's the thing. I don't know where to draw the line and say, hey, there are bad parts of American culture and there are bad parts of Japanese culture. Because
certainly.
They're very, very different cultures.
Because if you want to idolize Japanese culture, you got a couple things coming to you, too. Because there's toxic parts of
I mean,
of
that kind of like cog in a machine sort of thing.
Right,
is,
like all for the community, individuality, devalued.
Right. It has its own downsides.
Right.
But it also has upsides.
Maximizing individuality also has its downsides.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this movie is trying to get to some middle ground, but I think they really fuck it up at the end where Michael Douglas gives him these plates and says, be like me and rip off the system. Like,
yeah.
He is encouraging his newfound Japanese friend.
Just print yourself $10,000-$15,000.
To go against everything that is ingrained in Japanese culture and break the law by counterfeiting a whole bunch of American bills, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's essentially what he's encouraging him to do.
I want to put, because like, I think there's another interpretation that might actually be the correct one.
But he
one.
Says to him, look, if someone were to have both of these plates, mm-hmm. they would have no more problems.
Well, but
and then he gives him both of the plates.
Here's my interpretation, because I see where you're coming from, but I think what you're supposed to understand is that the Japanese guy suspects Michael Douglas of stealing the plates because he is a thief and he has no honor.
Okay.
And the Japanese guy's face falls like this guy hasn't
gotcha.
Learned a goddamn thing.
So then he gives
when the
them
plates
back.
Are in that present, he now realizes that he was just fucking with him.
Okay.
I think that's what we're supposed to understand, but...
God, that's... Mm.
But it's so... Like, his character arc is so muddied, both of them, honestly, that, like, I was kind of unsure, too.
Yeah.
I rewound it and watched it, and I'm like, oh, okay, I think this is what you're supposed to understand.
I never felt like they did a good enough job bringing Michael Douglas around to the values of Masa.
Right, because I think
to an equilibrium. It always felt like Michael Douglas was the overriding
right.
force in that, cultural force.
Yeah.
And to me, so I look at the end and I say, oh shit, he's encouraging his friend to break this mold, which he doesn't want to break.
Right.
And I think, oh, that's disgusting. But
well, the other thing is, like,
he could be right.
So many things that he, like, so Michael Douglas at one point, they're investigating a crime scene, and he's not even supposed to be there, which is another reason why I think, well, he's not even supposed to be there, and he steals, like, a stack of money, like $1,000.
Yeah.
And Mas reports him to his superiors, and they're going to deport him, send him home.
Mm-hmm.
And Michael Douglas reveals that he knew they were counterfeits, and he does it by burning one and blah, 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 like that. And then he's like, you should always talk to your partner before you talk to boss. I'm like, what about you, fuckface? How about not just stealing evidence for whatever reason? Like, what if you go to Maz, like, hey, man, these look like they're counterfeits. I think I got a burn test so we can try it for sure. You feel like burning $100? Like, like, you can't fucking point that finger at Maz without... four fat ones sticking back at you.
Yeah.
Because you are running roughshod over this guy for the entire movie. You disgrace him. You get him in trouble with superiors.
Oh, like, he's ruining his life. Like,
he really is.
He's not only has he lost his job.
He lost respect of his son.
He lost the respect of his family. All the family he has, I can tell.
It seems like it. Yeah.
He's dishonored himself.
Right.
He feels he's lost all his pride. Like,
but that's another through point that the film tries to make, where there's this theme of there are codes of conduct and people need to know when you should break them.
Mm-hmm.
The Yakuza makes that point. Like, yes, you can do you can eschew tradition from time to time, but you know, here's the parts where important. The police make that even. Even like Andy Garcia makes that point to Michael Douglas, but there's never a point where Michael Douglas gets his comeuppance. I guess Andy Garcia getting killed, but the way they filmed that is like Andy Garcia is a jackass. Like if Andy Garcia was acting less like a jackass in that moment, he'd still be alive. It's not so much as a come up.
Yeah.
I think that would work better if Michael Douglas had gotten Andy Garcia dead because of his pride and arrogance.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. There are moments where Michael Douglas,
I mean, this is close to,
is about to lose, which I guess are important. But yeah, I guess he doesn't. I wish his partner's death would have happened at a different time.
Mm.
I guess sometime where, like you said, it would be more evident that it was his fault.
Yes. And that's what I'm saying. Like, this movie is so close to being a classic.
I think so,
if the balls bounce a few different ways, if there was a little bit more time. And the thing is, like, I don't know. That's the question is, like, I don't know in 1989 if anyone saw this, because we were in this, like, economic war with Japan.
Yeah.
And they were seen broadly as kind of like the enemy and like this, like, you know, culture we didn't really understand. And, you know, like kind of the way, like, when Rocky shows up to fight Drago, they don't really give a fair characterization of the Russian people and what they're about.
Yeah.
You know, like when Michael Douglas comes to solve this crime in Osaka, it's not he's not coming as Andy Garcia trying to find a middle ground. He's like, I've got truth, justice, and the American way. And money laundering and counterfeiting and skimming off of the top. And this is the way. And y'all need to get fucking on board.
Yeah. No, it is a shame that I guess it's not a little bit better, because, or maybe, like, I wonder if I go back and I look at some of these other movies from the era that I love, if I looked at them more objectively, if I had seen this at the time, you know, maybe it would be more of a classic to me.
Yeah.
Because I think about, like, movies like Die Hard and stuff, and, I mean, they're doing a lot of the same things.
And they're ridiculous in their own way.
Right. And but I love those movies. Right. And it's only because I saw them at the time.
Right.
So maybe this is a victim of me just having not seen it at the time and looking at it 20, 30 years later, you know?
The other thing impressive about this movie is the number of dick kicks.
Oh, that Michael Douglas can sustain. Yes.
in the final fight
of
this movie.
He can really take a shot to the balls.
Like, that Sato guy, is that a guy, the upstart Yakuza?
Yeah.
He gets some wicked kicks right.
And
right,
punches.
Kicks and punches right to the beanbag on Michael Douglas, and Michael Douglas is not having it.
Yeah.
He digs deep and is able to, and that's the other thing is, I was about to laugh out loud because they did such a crazy job of backwards establishing this giant stake sticking out of ground that Michael Douglas could ram this guy through. And I'm like, this is not the way to do this. Like, you should have established that this is a threat, and like, you can't, like, right before you ram someone on it, like, eyeball it, and then the bad guy eyeballs it, and then you eyeball him, and then he eyeballs you,
and then,
like,
you smile at the camera and wink.
And then, like, then they show him, like, perp walking him into the station to the amazement of all the Japanese police, and I'm like, okay, thank God, because this was about to turn into farce.
I guess he learned the true spirit of Japanese policemanship in that moment. He could have killed the guy. I think Michael Douglas, 20 minutes earlier in the movie, would have killed that guy.
And that's a point that I think would have been cooler had the movie had a better vision of what it was about, because that's essentially Michael Douglas deciding to honor his living partner over avenging his dead one, who he kind of let down and disgraced anyway. It's kind of like, you know, that is actually a moment of growth.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so
clumsily
unsupported by.
Yeah, I think it was clumsily filmed.
Yeah. Oh, for sure.
That was not a truly inspiring moment of filmsmanship there. So,
right.
What are you gonna do?
I'm trying to think what else I want.
I mean, there's a lot of stuff. Like, okay, let's talk about the title, Black Rain. So they explain this somewhere in the middle of the movie when they get to Sagai. He's talking with Michael Douglas, and he tells them, basically, about
this is the Yakuza Godfather,
right? Yeah, and he tells Michael Douglas basically that Black Rain is a term, or that this idea of Black Rain was from right after when the bombs dropped, and they were, you know, living underground for days, and they came up, and there was this Black Rain
from all the fallout,
and then after that point, like, somewhere along the way, people lost, I guess, the true spirit of the Japanese culture.
Well,
in his
United
mind.
States, and this is true. United States came in. They completely uprooted the Japanese culture. They disbanded.
They changed a lot of things about it.
They wrote their constitution. They forbid them from bearing arms. And his thesis was it broke something essentially Japanese people. And this is why you've got in maniacs like Sato running around.
Yeah, and I feel like I'm trying to figure out where I come down on this, given the context of the movie.
Like, that's too important a topic to spend 30 seconds establishing and then abandoning.
I feel like the whole movie is trying to address it, but it's not quite hitting for me.
Yeah, like you need to make the movie about like Sato and his relationship with his bosses and like growing up and is that like
you almost
I would
need like
an exploration
translation,
of what
right?
dropping two atomic bombs on a largely already defeated people and then have
right.
these foreigners that you've always looked down on in this very xenophobic, racist way come in and tell you how they destroy your god emperor and then mm-hmm. like dictate terms to you and
right.
you're ruled for a decade by a military general and not allowed to carry arms. And like it's like that must be a trip.
Yeah.
To go through as a culture and a people.
For sure. And I don't think this movie does a great job of addressing
it. I'm no closer to understanding any of those themes than I was beginning this movie.
I just don't feel like this is the format, like this neo-noir
yeah, right.
crime thriller is the format to explore that topic.
Like you need something like Graveyard of the Fireflies.
Or Blade Runner. Like you need a Blade Runner feel to it for this person to come into this foreign land and maybe be... you know, pig-headed like Michael Douglas is at the beginning, but come farther along that journey. Like,
right.
I want him to truly understand what it means to be a Japanese person after the war.
Right.
As opposed to just, like, halfway meeting this one detective because he likes the dude and they had some gun battles together.
Yeah, no, I agree with you on that.
Just don't think it was very good. And then this Sugai guy, we talked about his voice. It's incredible. But after he explains this Black Rain thing, you see him in a scene just chain smoking, and he's got an assistant who is handing him the cigarettes. His lieutenant assisted uh-huh. chain smoking, and I'm like, uh-huh. you did not get enough cancer juice from the bomb. You're looking to just end your life early, aren't you? That's
right,
rough.
Maybe.
That's
maybe.
Really right. He's the only guy in the room smoking.
I mean, if I bathed in Black Rain of radioactive fallout from an atomic bomb, I think I would
You'd think
I would be like, you know what? Yeah. I'm going to do whatever the hell. I'm going to eat burnt bacon. I'm going to chain
nothing
smoke.
Nothing to cut up my
I'm
chances
to,
more.
I'm going to get 50 chest x-rays a year.
Yeah.
I'm going to take 100 transatlantic high-altitude flights. Like, I just want all the carcinogens all the time. I'm going to have my pajamas made out of asbestos. yeah.
Yep.
Do you have anything else you want to talk about, or should we get to Sean Ray, kind of, like, go back now that we've established our true thoughts of the film? I hope Sean gets the impression that, like I said, I didn't hate this film.
No, no, no.
And I kind of admired a lot of the stuff it was trying to do. I guess, if Ridley Scott made this movie 20 years later, or somehow took a sensibility of America from 20 years later and then made the film at the time, it'd have been a much better film.
Yeah, it's definitely hurt by the time it was made.
Or made it focused on Andy Garcia and Michael Douglas is the you know, oafish buffoon. Maybe Michael Douglas
right.
Dies, and then Andy Garcia decides how to best honor his complicated memory.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, because I really like the Andy Garcia character.
Yeah, no, he seemed like a good guy, and they have like this whole karaoke scene with
him.
I
think it's weird taking your shoes off or you're riding postillion on the back of a motorcycle and waving in some dude's face. Like, I was trying to think of how that worked. Like, you're in your, you get your coattails flying and you get your foot on the foot pegs and you're just going to reach down there by that hot ass exhaust pipe and you're going to pull off a shoe and you're going to wave it in front of Michael Douglas's face and brag about how expensive they are.
I guess
that's a weird ass scene, man. It's a weird ass scene.
It is. There are a few of them in here.
I
don't know why the Japanese detectives or the Japanese police force didn't just send them home to begin with. Like, I guess give them the opportunity to do their own police work?
Especially since
civilians.
Michael Douglas was just so offensive and disrespectful and
just
unhelpful.
Force these fools back into a plane
from the beginning.
To New York.
Yeah.
And they finally try it after he mucks everything up, but they don't get very far with that, I guess. The airport security over there is not what it is in 2018 America.
Mm-hmm. So do you want to talk about where this fits in the Ridley Scott pantheon?
Well, first I want to talk very quickly about the police work that is done in this movie, because I feel like it's also of the era where now you would have a much more techno-centric kind of thriller, I think. Mm-hmm. You just don't get these like hard-boiled, hit the streets, pound the pavement kind of police.
Certainly have a lot of microscopes analysis of the fibers of the bills.
And you wouldn't have the scene where he goes in and he trashes Sato's hideout.
Right.
And then finds the sequins, which point him apparently to the only woman in Japan who wears sequins.
Right.
Which is the gaijin lady, whatever her name is.
Yeah, Kate Capshaw.
Yeah. I thought that was funny. But yeah, the style of police work is very of the time, too.
Where does this fit into the his overall body of work? Because I was going through his early stuff, you know, he's got Alien Classic, Blade Runner Classic, Legend. I don't care for it, but, you know,
I'm not sure I've seen that one.
That's Tom Cruise Fights the Devil.
No, I haven't seen that.
Essentially, I think that's the one. Or am I getting that? Yeah, no, that's definitely Tom Cruise. Mm-hmm. And Tim Curry is the devil. And it's this high, like, weird fantasy concept thing he's got going on. I don't think it holds up, but I think this is where the Black Rain kind of era fits in. Thelma and Louise is better. I haven't seen 1492 or White Squall. I have seen G.I. Jane. I feel like it's around G.I. Jane, kind of like a broad characterization of some intersections of interesting parts of the culture that Ridley Scott doesn't do a great job of having an interesting or informative thing to say. You know, have you seen G.I. Jane?
No.
That's Demi Moore's becoming the first female Navy SEAL.
Yeah, I know it's bad. I haven't seen it.
And Viggo Mortensen is the villain. And he's really good as the Navy SEAL drill instructor. Gladiator is a better movie. Hannibal. Mm-hmm. What do you think of Hannibal? Because I think Hannibal's kind of a mess, too.
Shit, I don't know that I've ever seen Hannibal.
You've not seen Hannibal?
I've seen parts of it. I know. I've seen, like, the brain scene.
Right.
But I don't think I've seen the whole movie.
Black Hawk Down is way better. Matchstick Men is way better. Yeah. I haven't seen Kingdom of Heaven. American Gangster is like on another level.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't seen The Body of Lies. I saw the Robin Hood remake with Russell Crowe. I get it's kind of at that level. Like I said, like I haven't seen a bad Ridley Scott film in here.
Mm-hmm.
Like even Alien Covenant, I wouldn't describe as a bad movie. I'd describe it as a wrongheaded chapter in the Alien lore, but it's not a terrible movie.
No,
it's just a movie that probably didn't need to be made and didn't answer any questions. So I guess I would put it into that bottom third, like not failures, but they have enough significant missteps and slightly muddled attempts at what they're trying to do that they're not, certainly not some of the classics and masterpieces of his other stuff.
Right.
Do we want to entertain where Michael Douglas fits in the badass pantheon? Would you care to explain the pantheon to people that might have been hearing this concept for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, the pantheon is just like badass action heroes of the ages. And we have a three, I guess, criteria system for rating them. What are the names? I know they're three C's.
There's the champion. Like, they're physical. Right. Physical. Are they a physical? You look at them and you're like, Jesus Christ, that's a physical champion.
Yeah. There's charisma.
Charisma.
To like how, basically, how charming are they? Like Bruce Willis scores highly on that. Like
if they come up and say, "Fuck you, pal," like does it seem desperate or does it seem impressive?
Yeah,
like Clint Eastwood comes and growls "fuck you" in your face, like you sit up and take notice. You know, Zach Galifianakis does it, and you're like, "This is just sad."
Yeah,
he can't. Zach Galifianakis cannot be a badass.
And then there's the third C, which is the characters that they play.
If you,
how good and awesome are the characters that they have portrayed?
Right, like if
with
you
Arnold Schwarzenegger being like the top character,
and the poster boy for that would be like Keanu Reeves.
Sure.
I would never consider Keanu Reeves a badass on any of the other C's.
Right.
But God damn it, he's played enough badass characters and pulled it off that you have to consider him a badass.
Yeah, between John Wick and Neo.
Neo
alone.
And,
like,
right,
those two.
Speed, like, he's got enough action credentials on IMDb that you cannot leave him out of the conversation.
Yeah.
Unfortunately,
there's
Michael
nothing
Douglas,
particularly badass in this movie that Michael Douglas does.
Michael Douglas is He doesn't have the characters. In fact, this is the only kind of like badass role I can even think. And he, he's channeling Philip from the Americans picking up a 14-year-old in his most badass phases, which is not badass,
right?
So he doesn't have the characters. His charisma is much more oily.
Yeah,
like Wall Street. Yeah, like he's got the sleazy charisma,
which I don't really view as charisma, honestly. Like,
yeah, I think he could steal your girlfriend. That's a type of charisma,
yeah, and talk you out of your life savings.
I don't think he could walk into a Yakuza bar and have anybody rethinking their life choices.
No, no,
the way like a John McClane or like a Dirty Harry could.
No, he doesn't seem charming. He seems convincing, I guess, at what he's trying to do, but not in the same way.
And as far as his physical championness, I would say that he is dead at, like, he looks like an average guy. He looks like he could handle himself the way an average guy could handle themselves in any kind of fight or martial contest.
That's the thing. Like, I don't think I would be particularly scared of Michael Douglas in a fight.
No.
If Michael Douglas came trying to pick a fight, I'd be like, I don't really want to fight, dude, but like, it's not Arnold Schwarzenegger trying to pick a fight with me.
If Michael Douglas is the head of my law firm or Wall Street training and he came in with a head of steam and he's pissed off about something, I might be afraid of him for my job.
Yes.
Well, I wouldn't be afraid that he would, like, you know,
pick me up and break me in half.
Right, right. Like tear me in half like a phone book the way like a Dwayne The Rock Johnson or an Arnold Schwarzenegger in his glory days could just, you know.
Right.
Show up naked in a biker bar and it's not completely laughable.
Yeah.
Like Michael Douglas shows up naked in a biker bar. He doesn't clean house. I don't know what happens, but he certainly doesn't clean house. Best case scenario is he talks himself into the bed of one of the barmaids.
Right.
Every other scenario goes poorly for him.
So he gets half a C for character or for charisma? For the oily kind of talk you out of your savings charisma.
It's not badass charisma.
That's true. It's not badass.
Like Jason Isaacs, another guy.
He's not delivering any
one-liners,
right?
Jason Isaacs is not
right?
a badass. Like, he's got that same oily kind of like shifty, clever kind of charisma.
Yeah, there are no one-liners that Michael Douglas is going to deliver and you're going to go, yeah.
I mean, his one-liners in this year, I wrote a couple of them down.
He calls everybody babe in this? I don't really like that.
That's not
that
good.
That was weird.
I usually get kissed before I get fucked.
Yeah, that was not good.
Not a badass line. Mm-mm. Not a badass line. He headbutts a guy and just says, I just wanted to talk. Not a badass. Sometimes you got to forget your head and grab your balls.
Okay.
If John McClane had said that to Carl Winslow.
Yep.
As he's trying to get Carl Winslow to get off his ass and do something he knows he needs to do, badass.
Right.
In context and character, I'm like, no, use your head more, man. Yep. This ball stuff has done nothing but get your partner killed. But yeah, no. I unfortunately I don't think he fits in the pantheon. He doesn't fit in the pantheon of badasses. He's like in the same tier of Adrian Brody is. Adrian Brody had one film, Predators, where they tried to pass him off as a badass. It was a laughable failure, and he time shares that slot with Michael Douglas.
Yeah, okay, I'm with you.
Let's see. Oh, so we can talk about some of his favorite scenes: a shootout diner in New York. Let's see, the chase through the packaging plant, Charlie's death in the parking garage, which we both commented on. That's pretty effective, amazingly effective for where we were in a part of the movie and how I felt about Michael Douglas's character.
Yeah.
The scene where Nick and Masashiro share a drink after Charlie's death, that's one where he accuses him of being a thief and disgracing his partner. Hmm. The final fight in the fields. So that was interesting because I saw a lot of the technical creaky points. Like I could see the squibs on people. And like there's one scene where Michael Douglas takes a shot at Sato as he's running through these sheets, like on, and you could see like these pie plate size things. And I'm like, just before that, I'm like, I can see your squibs there, guys.
Huh.
What did you think about the culture clash of the Americans and Japanese? Like we talked about that. The decision of Nick not to kill Sato but to bring him in. I think that's the best and really That's the best character beat that Michael Douglas has.
Sure.
And
with maybe the exception of the recontextualized end, I guess, now that I have to ponder that.
But even then, he's making it, he's kind of, I guess that's fine. to joke about a guy being straight-laced.
Yeah. Oh, I think so.
But the joke is I'm
exactly what you think I am. Oh, wait, I'm not.
Yeah, right, right.
Oh, wait, you've taught me something.
Right. I'll still shake a goon down for money, but I'm not going to counterfeit.
Right.
I'm not going to become a counterfeiter.
Yeah.
We talked about the badass scale. So there you go. Mm-hmm. Sean Ray, thank you for commissioning yet another podcast. I hope you, if you didn't like, you know, I don't know, man. Anytime we have like anything that's less than gushing, I always worry about what the commissioner is going to think. But I hope you thought it was interesting and funny.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly tried my best to take the film seriously as it warranted. Gave it a fair shot.
Yeah.
We'll see what we come up with next time. I think we've got the movie La Haine, which I know nothing about that's coming out next, but I'm not sure about that because there was a little bit of the commissioner maybe thinking about something different. We also have Looper coming up and Heat. Looper I have not seen, but I'm excited to. That's a Rian Johnson.
For some reason, I thought you and I went and saw that together when it came out.
I know, like, it's John McClane and...
And is it JDM? No, not JDM.
Joseph Gordon-Levitt.
JGL. Yeah,
I think yeah. So like I've wanted to see that. And it's Rian Johnson's one of his first movies he's made after he kind of got started on Breaking Bad, mm-hmm. and then Heat. I haven't seen that movie in like 15 years, but I have phenomenal memories of it. And
right.
I cannot wait to. Have you seen Heat?
I have. Yeah.
Everybody's seen Heat.
Right.
Heat's amazing. It's
going
to be
awesome.
It's
one of those like Point Break type of movies where everybody of the era saw it, you know, and remembers it.
Except for I have the memory of it being much, much better than anything like Point Break.
Oh, well, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. But we got that stuff coming out. So stay tuned to that. We'll be getting to that in the weeks, the weeks to come. Mm-hmm. We also got some fantasy football stuff that we got slated in that we got to get going as well. And I got those are Prisoners. That's a Denis Villeneuve, I think, film that we've been wanting to see for a long time.
Hmm.
A couple others coming up. So, yeah, stay tuned on the Bald Movies channel to see all these commissioned podcasts will be coming out in January and February. And we will see you on the next one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
I'm Jim.
Bye.